Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the California Healthcare Foundation. I am Joe Epstein, past president and member of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome the listeners of WOIAM in Ames, Iowa, one of the more than 200 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners here and on radio to join the Commonwealth Club on the World Wide Web at commonwealthclub.org. This evening's program is one in an ongoing series co-sponsored by the Commonwealth Club and the California Healthcare Foundation in an effort to examine important health policy issues in this election year. This program is brought to you from the Lakeview Club overlooking beautiful Lake Merritt in Oakland, California. And I might add that at this very podium at the Lakeview Club in Oakland, newly elected President of Mexico, Vicente Fox, addressed our audience in August of 1998. And I know that if President Fox were listening to tonight's radio broadcast, he would be very interested in this discussion because improved and expanded health care carries far-reaching implications for the people of Mexico and the new administration of Vicente Fox. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mark Smith, President and CEO of the California Healthcare Foundation, who will introduce today's panel moderator. Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Joe. I'm pleased to welcome everyone here this evening to what promises to be a very interesting debate between two nationally recognized figures on issues related to HMOs, Karen Ignani and Ron Pollack. This evening's debate is the third event in a new health policy speaker series in partnership with the Commonwealth Club of California. The next two upcoming events are on August 3rd, when Dr. Jane Henney, Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, will speak in Santa Clara, and on September 15th, when Dr. David Satcher, Surgeon General of the United States, will speak in San Francisco. The Foundation is committed to promoting a thoughtful discussion of health policy issues in California, and there's no organization better suited to provide a forum for that discussion than the Commonwealth Club of California. In addition to our prominent speakers, we'll continue to work with the Commonwealth Club to convey to voters and citizens the positions of senatorial and presidential and California congressional candidates on important health care issues in the weeks and months ahead. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to introduce the moderator of tonight's debate, David Olmos, who is health editor of the Los Angeles Times. I'm sure that many of you, like me, have been reading David's byline for years now. He's a 12-year veteran of the Times and has been involved in healthcare journalism since 1993. He was named health editor in 1998 and is responsible for overseeing the editorial content of that newspaper's weekly health section. Under David's leadership, the section has become nationally known for its in-depth coverage of critical health issues and its focus on consumer health issues of the day. And I introduce David Olmos. David?
Thank you, Mark. Well, I'm delighted to be here this evening to talk about a subject that is obviously very, very important to all of us. Managed care is a subject that's been front and center in the news for nearly a decade now, and a subject that, of course, is of vital importance to all of us. I've been covering health care as a reporter and editor at the Los Angeles Times for about 8 years. And when I first began writing about this subject in the early 90s, managed care was just beginning to build momentum in this country, and this was although HMOs had been a presence in California for nearly 50 years at that time. In other parts of the country, it was still a bit something of an oddity, something that patients and consumers found mystifying and that many doctors at that time distrusted quite a bit. At that time, it was still a bit unclear whether managed care would become the dominant form of health care in this country, although it was looking more and more like it. People in the HMO industry were much more likely than they are today to compare the performance in medical quality and other important measures of health care to the old fee-for-service system, as if the two health payment types were locked in a fight for survival. Today, the battle seems to really be over, And it seems very clear today that managed care is not only the dominant form of health care, but that it's here to stay with us for some time. Fee-for-service, the old type of system, is virtually non-existent in California now and slowly dying in many other parts of the country. Patients and doctors, however, still have their gripes about the system, and we read about those in the paper all the time. But by and large, I would say that many patients and many physicians have really begun to adapt to some of the changes. Maybe they don't like all of them, but certainly we're much more familiar with it than we were 10 years ago. Now, of course, we may read a story every now and then about a stubborn or idealistic doctor who is bucking the trend by shunning HMOs and trying to do things the old-fashioned way. And we'll still read, of course, the occasional HMO, quote, horror story about some real or perceived problem with the system. But as I said, managed care is here to stay, and most of us and our families will have to count on the managed care system in the years ahead. So to me, the important question really seems to be, how do we make managed care and the healthcare system in general work better for all of us? What is the role of managed care in tackling a lot of the difficult issues that face us, from rising prescription drug prices to revamping Medicare or reducing the vast numbers of uninsured in this country? Now, I know that our speakers are full of thoughts and great ideas about these subjects, so I'd like to go ahead and introduce them now. Karen Ignani is president and chief executive of the American Association of Health Plans. She is the nation's leading authority on public policy, legislative, and public affairs issues that challenge the managed care industry and all of us today. Under her leadership, the managed care industry has been transformed into an internationally recognized model of health care, covering nearly 175 million Americans. Her accolades are numerous. In September 1999, Washingtonian Magazine named her one of the top guns of all industry trade association chiefs, quoting that Ms. Ignani is widely considered one of the best and most influential in town. In July 1999, the New York Times profiled Karen, writing, quote, in a city teeming with healthcare lobbyists, Ms. Ignani is widely considered one of the most effective. She blends a detailed knowledge of health policy with an intuitive feel for politics. And also National Journal, another magazine, has called her 1,000-member trade association a force to be reckoned with on Capitol Hill. Prior to coming to the association, Karen, in 1993, Karen directed the AFL-CIO Department of Employee Benefits. And for 4 years prior to that, she was a professional staff member of the U.S. Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee. And prior to that, in the late 1970s, she was an assistant executive director for the Committee for National Health Insurance. And even before that, a research analyst for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Our other speaker tonight is Ron Pollack, who is executive director of Families USA, which is a national organization for healthcare consumers. In 1997 and 98, Ron was appointed the sole consumer representative on the Presidential Advisory Commission on Consumer Protection and Quality in the Healthcare Industry. Now, Families USA is an organization that does a lot of analysis on healthcare and puts out a lot of reports on such subjects as HMO, consumer-related protection, coverage for the uninsured and uninsured families, public health programs such as Medicaid and Medicare, and also long-term care. And Ron and his organization are frequently cited at congressional hearings, in state legislatures, and by the media as a consumer organization that works with other organizations all throughout the country. Prior to his current position at Families USA, Ron was dean of the Antioch University School of Law, and he was also the founding executive director of the Food Research and Action Center, which is a national organization focused on the elimination of hunger in the United States. We're going to get started this evening with some remarks by Karen and Ron that will last for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we're going to leave a lot of time for questions and answers after they conclude their remarks. So I would encourage all of you to be thinking about questions and send them on up to us as we go along. So we'll get started with Karen.
Thank you, David. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. Also a pleasure to be in California with Ron, with whom I often have these sorts of opportunities, and I think he's one of the most thoughtful individuals in Washington, so it's a pleasure to be here with him on your turf, not on ours in Washington. I also want to thank my colleagues from the health plan community that came out tonight. I appreciate your taking time for your families to come and join us for this discussion, and I'm looking forward to your questions as well. I want to also thank the Commonwealth Club for putting quality on the agenda. We often have many opportunities to discuss health care, but very rarely do we get to the question of quality and the track record. But I can't help but observe that the title for this evening's discussion, How Good is the Care that Consumers Are Getting Under Managed Care, has an edge to it. It seems that there's a little bit of a skepticism there, or a show-me subtext. And I think that we in the managed care community need to confront that straight on. The research shows that we have a solid track record of accomplishment, but also there's been a dramatic departure from the past, and I think therein has laid the seeds for some of the political issues and the challenges we face, shall we say, today. And consider this, that as David said, less than in a decade, we've gone from being the alternative in the delivery system to becoming the dominant model. And although it's rarely discussed this way in this context, there has been a revolution in healthcare on the order of the Industrial Revolution that occurred 100 years ago, or the computer revolution, the e-revolution that we're involved in today. And I think that also gives us some insight into the magnitude of the changes. And with this change, just as in other sectors, we've seen organized opposition spring up from those who seek to preserve the old system. We see trial lawyers have seen greener pastures and have sought to exercise their ability to move into this area very aggressively. And finally, we've seen politicians who are seeking to run against something. They've found a comfortable territory, and they've embraced the agenda of the two previous groups. Now, meanwhile, we in the managed care industry haven't done enough to discuss what people can expect from our care systems. How are our decisions made? How are we responding to legitimate provider concerns about administrative procedures and processes? And how are we assuring every day consumers that they can have confidence in the system, that it will work fairly and effectively, that there will be procedural justice? Tonight I'd like to discuss the value that we've brought to the system, how it compares to the situation 10 years ago, the challenges that we face in managed care specifically, but also I think the challenges that each and every one of us face as stakeholders in this system. I think that to capture where we are in healthcare right now, the Center for Disease Control said it best, that managed care offers a medical home to those whose care has been episodic and fragmented. Consider that what is the best healthcare system in the world had 10 years ago unexplained wide variation in physician practice around the country and an over-reliance on inpatient care. Health plans have used research to address overuse, misuse, and underuse, providing care at the right time, in the right setting, and in the right place. We've had a fragmented system without linkages, without connectivity, which has become such a major issue today, and we've sought to replace that with care coordination. We've had the best leadership in medical technology, which led to overutilization that offered marginal benefits and sometimes downright risky and dangerous procedures. We've implemented outcomes assessment using guidelines and research to try to shrink that system and that performance. We've had a disease versus a healthcare focused. Managed care has pioneered early intervention and disease management. We've had a lack of infrastructure to put quality improvements in place, an inability to measure progress. We've been able to track effectiveness of beta blockers, retinal exams for diabetics, and whether or not we are screening properly for early detection, cancer, and so many other diseases. And finally, in fact, for many of the individuals listening tonight, we had a system 10 years ago where many found that they were locked out of it because of very high prohibitive health care costs, and they were at risk of losing their benefits. Throughout the last decade, managed care has saved $300 billion. that would have been allocated according to Congressional Budget Office projections to health care. And we've made it possible for an additional 6 million people to have access to the system that we have today. Now, what does the research show? I also want to get to that very specific aspect of this question. It shows that cardiovascular care on that basis, on that for that issue, we're doing better than the old system. It shows that breast cancer screening, we're 1.5 times more likely to have it in managed care, that the survival rate in managed care is higher, that cervical cancer, 1.4 times more likely to undergo screening, women in our systems. We've played a major role in leveling the incidence of all types of cancer care, according to the National Cancer Institute. We've pioneered childhood asthma programs. We've gotten children out of the ER. You're more likely in a managed care system to receive smoking cessation advice and counseling, and more likely as a diabetic to undergo eye exams and appropriate follow-up. The New Republic said just several months ago that Americans' health care is better now than it was a decade ago, and that cost has stabilized. That is the legacy of managed care. So given that track record, what explains the edginess of the original question? And I think it's twofold. First, amid the changes that have gone on, we're often defined by those who want to turn back the clock. But at the same time, we can't let the explanation rest there. We in the managed care community have not done enough to speak for ourselves about our track record. We haven't done enough to confront the challenge of and answer the rhetorical question often put, what is our ethical code? How do we work? What can people expect? And it's easier for others to engage in demagoguery while we're not taking the advantage to step into the spotlight and answer those very legitimate questions. At the same time that we have this legacy, at the same time we have this track record, there are challenges that we have to confront. The year 2000 is going to be about change, and indeed you've begun to see it all around the country. Health plans, embracing the concept of administrative simplification. We're doing top-down reviews of administrative policies and procedures. We know that physicians have been frustrated by paperwork. We know that they have been frustrated by utilization review procedures that aren't targeted where they need to be targeted. We know that there are issues with respect to referral processes that are burdensome, and we know there are questions and concerns about prompt payment. We have been laying down strategies that throughout this year you're going to be hearing a great deal about to respond on a community basis to each of these very legitimate concerns. At the same time, from a consumer perspective, we know that they need the best and better customer service, and they need to have assurance that there's a place, an ombuds program, or a place that they can go in each and every health plan where they can have their questions and concerns met. We also know that there are a variety of products out there and options and an explosion of opportunities for individuals who seek to customize their health care and seek it in a slightly different way than you or I. But we know that many individual employees are frustrated by their inability to access that because they're not given access to those options through their employer, while at the same time we've developed those options in managed care. I think these are the issues that have fueled the political debate. They've created a disconnect between the current dialogue and the accomplishments of our community, but the experience has demonstrated that we need to confront these issues head on. We need to be leaders in the managed care community, not expecting anyone else to do it, to bridge the disconnect. I think there's no example that's more appropriate to capture the value of our care systems and the stake that individuals who are involved in them have in their going away, but the Medicare Plus Choice program, which is a program where Medicare beneficiaries on fixed incomes have come to expect cost containment protection, catastrophic services, additional benefits to supplement the traditional benefit program, all before we get to prescription drugs, which many people are offering. So I think that there are many challenges for us. There's a very positive and proud track record, but there's also, in concluding, challenges for the entire country that affect how individuals in managed care receive their care, how all of us maneuver through the healthcare system. And I just, in interest of time, I'll just illustrate a couple. First, how do we find the political will to commit the resources to cover the 44 million people who don't have coverage? How do we protect privacy but not shut down research and disease management activities? How do we assess new technology and absorb its costs? Who is to make these decisions? And is it going to be acceptable for that to be made on a plan-by-plan basis, or are there better societal ways to address that? How can we institute accountability across the board for all players, all stakeholders, and how can we begin to change the regulatory model for one that's focused on transactional regulation, peace regulation, to one that's focused on performance standards? In conclusion, I think that where this takes us is that there are no villains or heroes, that there are good people in various communities throughout the healthcare system trying to make the system better. We've learned that the future of managed care turns on successful provider relationships and putting patients first. And after all the demagoguery, I believe that we now have an opportunity to, in fact, engage in the real debate to the question of where do we put the fulcrum between competition versus regulation. That age-old question was never settled. That indeed is the question that underlines the entire healthcare debate. It's never an either-or proposition. We in the managed care community believe very strongly that external review, offering an independent opportunity for individuals to receive a second opinion, if you will, is a very good place to begin as a platform for this discussion. It's been a pleasure to be with you tonight, and I look forward to your questions, and I look forward to Ron's remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. We'll go next to Ron Pollack.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. The first time Karen and I debated on this issue was, I think it was a Fox television program, and Karen taught me something very important about debating, something no one's ever done to me before. She brought her young son to the studio with her, and so I had to talk to her son beforehand, and of course, he's a lovely child, and so I had to obviously be much softer in my remarks. And just before we got up here, she showed me a photograph of her. I had a feeling, speaking after Karen and David, I was actually a little worried what would I say after the two of them have spoken. Sort of reminded me of a situation I had a few years ago where I wasn't sure whether I could really add something to the remarks that came before me. And I was speaking, I was looking around the room as I am now, and it was wonderful. I focused on a woman seated in the fourth row who was taking copious notes of everything I was saying, and I felt, this is terrific. I'm actually reaching out to somebody, and I could feel the adrenaline coursing through my body, and I thought I actually gave a pretty good speech. At the conclusion of the speech, I was waiting, and a bunch of people came up, but she was the very first person to come up, and she had this wonderful, warm smile on her face. She said, "Mr. Pollack, I want to thank you. You were absolutely superfluous." So I thanked her, because I wasn't sure what to say to her. But she went on, and she said, "Now, Mr. Pollack, I want to know, do you intend to do any writing on the subject?" So I thought a moment, and in the spirit of her previous remark, I said, "Yes, I intend to do some writing on this subject, and I hope to have it published posthumously." And she looked at me with this twinkle in her eye, and she said, "You know, that's just wonderful, Mr. Pollack, because, you know, it just couldn't happen too soon." I want to take off where start where Karen left us. Karen opened up by saying something I thought that was very appropriate. We really have had a revolution in our healthcare system, and although it's been a quiet revolution, it's been a profound revolution, and it had its roots obviously in what Henry J. Kaiser started decades ago as an alternative to our healthcare system. And it had its roots in trying to improve quality of care. and it was intended to promote primary care and preventive care and to make sure that there was good coordination of care and that there'd be meaningful accountability among the various health care providers. And that was done, I think, more easily in a staff model HMO setting. Now, as Karen indicated, we've had an enormous revolution, and David mentioned it before. In 1985, fewer than one in three people were in managed care plans, and today the overwhelming majority of people are in managed care plans. And that revolution occurred largely at the motivation of the payers of health care. The payers of health care wanted this revolution. And let's be clear that the primary motivation of the payers of care was to deal with the burgeoning costs of our health care system and what they were paying out of pocket. And so the primary motivation that has goaded this revolution is to try to decelerate health care costs. And I don't mean to suggest that the payers of care are unmindful of quality. They certainly, many of them are, most of them probably are. But the thing that clearly they could measure that was easy to understand was cost. And quality, while it certainly was a significant consideration, is far more difficult to measure and quantify. Now, accompanying this growth in managed care was truly a revolution in how we pay for care. The change from fee-for-service to a capitated payment has had some extraordinary impacts. Clearly, with our fee-for-service system, there was every motivation on the part of decision-makers of healthcare to provide more and more services, more and more tests, and if they had to err in one way, they would err in favor of over-provision of services. And that had a significant impact on costs. Today, with a capitated payment where everybody in effect, the payment is one single payment irrespective of the services that are provided, the economic motivations have changed. If you want to improve the bottom line, then you have to provide somewhat fewer services. You've got to be more sensitive about who you pick in your risk selection. There's a greater importance placed on productivity, which often means less time physician and patient together. And there are fewer opportunities for uncompensated care. Now, Karen mentioned that we have had a lot of Sturm und Drang, if you will, about managed care. And I'd like to suggest to you what I think is at the root of this. I don't think it is merely a set of stories from the media about the latest horror story in managed care. I'd like to suggest to you that there are three factors that are very profound that have caused this backlash to take place. The first is that there is extraordinary consumer bewilderment and confusion about our current healthcare system. With the fragmentation of our healthcare system, people do not understand their new choices, the new limitations, and many feel very lost, even highly educated people. Secondly, what has also happened is that people feel a sense of disempowerment. They feel disempowerment with respect to the course of treatment that they and family members receive, and in some instances, they feel that even their physicians have been disempowered as well, and that concerns them greatly. And thirdly, I would suggest to you that it's not so much the stories in the media, but it's the experiences that people have had directly themselves. Just last month, the Kaiser Foundation and Consumers Union released a survey that was intended to be representative of people nationally. And what they found was the evaluations, the grades that were being given to their plans differed rather considerably between those who were in the traditional plans and those who are in managed care. The numbers are rather staggering, and I'd be happy to go over them to you, with you. 51% of the people who were surveyed reported having some type of problem with their health plan last year. And the top two cited problems that they said were delays or denials of care and secondly, difficulty seeing a physician. So now we're having a debate about what is the proper role of regulation, and I'd like to take my time, the remainder of my time, just to talk a little bit about that. We're having a debate about patients' Bill of Rights, particularly in Washington. I think that that patient's Bill of Rights is necessary and important. But I want to explain what I think is a good patient's Bill of Rights and what is a bad patient's Bill of Rights. When I think of patient's Bill of Rights, I'm not thinking about three things. I'm not thinking, for example, about rules that determine what a health plan should be provide, what kind of services should be offered, what the benefits are. That is not part of a patient's Bill of Rights. Secondly, the patient's Bill of Rights does not address the most important issue facing the American public with our health care system, and that is, what do we do about people who are uninsured? 44.3 million Americans who are uninsured. And lastly, a patient's Bill of Rights is not about government dictating clinical care. That would be a very dangerous thing for us to be doing, and that is not what I think a good patient's Bill of Rights is about. So what is a patient's Bill of Rights that makes some sense? I suggest to you it's a modest agenda. It's a modest agenda that is designed to provide procedural protections to make sure that when people don't get the care that they thought they were supposed to get when they bought health care coverage or had it bought for them, that they have some procedures in place that they can invoke to try to get that care. Let me give you some examples. A right to emergency care. If you feel that you're experiencing an emergency, you have a right to go to the nearest emergency room without a prior authorization. We had the story in the Washington Post, Karen probably remembers, first page of Washington Post, of a woman who was hiking the Appalachian Trail. She fell down a cliff. She was unconscious. Her hiking partner went to get help, was able to get help. She was helicoptered to the nearest hospital. She was unconscious throughout the whole time. She got the care that she needed. After her health care was restored, the hospital sought payment for the services, and the HMO said, we're not going to provide it. She did not have a prior authorization. Well, I do a lot of, as Karen knows, I do a lot of hiking. I've come back recently from Nepal, my third time. I now take prior authorizations with me in case I fall in a crevasse. Patient's Bill of Rights does some other things. It means that if you're denied care you should be receiving, you can appeal that promptly to an independent decision maker who is independent of an HMO. It means that drugs that are not on a formulary that might be very beneficial to you because they're more efficacious or cause fewer side effects, your doctor has an opportunity to prescribe drugs off of the formulary. It means that you can go outside of the network if the network you have is inadequate in terms of your own special health care needs. It means that physicians are protected against retaliation when they advocate on behalf of their patients. And lastly, it means that there's some accountability, including, if ultimately necessary, the right to sue. Now, why do we need a patient's Bill of Rights? I suggest to you there are several reasons. One, it will restore confidence. It'll give people a greater sense of empowerment. Secondly, I don't believe that the marketplace today is likely to drive quality sufficiently to give people a sense of confidence about that quality. Too many people do not have choices about the health plans they can go to, particularly in other parts of the country. And that means they can't vote with their feet, and that means that they can't invoke the typical market forces that do drive quality. And perhaps most importantly, what we have today, actually, is a crazy quilt pattern of regulation of HMOs. And that is due to federal law that has been in place since 1974, the so-called ERISA statute, which governs how we regulate HMOs and insurance companies. And as a result of current law, not only do we have very significant differences from one state to the other, in terms of what rights you have, but people in the same state have very different rights depending on who's paying for their health care. If you're in Medicaid, you have one set of rights. Medicare, another set of rights. If you buy insurance independently, another set of rights. If you get your coverage from an employer who purchases insurance, yet another set of rights. And if your employer self-insures, yet a totally different set of rights. A patient's bill of rights will help set a floor that nobody can fall through. And lastly, a patient's bill of rights is inexpensive. The Congressional Budget Office tells us that a patient's bill of rights, even including a right to sue, would only cost over the course of 10 years 4% in additional premiums. I don't mean to suggest that 4% is nothing, but I suggest to you that most people are willing to pay that in order to make sure that the care they wanted is actually provided. I'm going to save for questions stuff about this litigation issue, because I know that's a very contentious issue, and so we'll talk about that later. But let me conclude by saying I think there are some things that we should be doing beyond the patient's bill of rights, where I hope that we can achieve consensus among the plan community and consumer community as well. In addition to passing a patient's bill of rights, I think there are four things I would identify quickly. One, let's try and deal with the confusion and bewilderment that America's consumers have with their healthcare system. And I think there's no better way to do that than create and adequately fund a consumer assistance or ombudsman program in every community in the country so that people can get their questions answered, and if they have problems, they can get resolved quickly rather than have to go to the court system. Secondly, let's make sure that we make available to consumers and accessible to consumers what the healthcare decision-making basis is. We have one of the benefits of managed care is that we can set up accountability system. We can now proliferate clinical guidelines that improve scientific medicine. But most Americans have never, ever seen any clinical guidelines. And normally when I've gone to plans, I've been told that's proprietary information. California, by the way, has the only statute in the country that now makes those clinical guidelines available to the public. And I think we've got to make sure those are utilized in ways that consumers can understand so they understand the rationale behind the care that they're receiving. Thirdly, we must improve the technology about risk adjustment. And the reason we need to do that, when I mean risk adjustment, what should we pay the insurers and the health plans based on the health conditions of individuals enrolling in those plans? If everyone's paying the exact same thing, if we're not providing some way to make sure that compensation is provided to plans when they take on greater risks, they'll shun those greater risks. And it means those people who are at greater risk will not get the care that they need. And lastly, obviously, we need to do much more in terms of getting comparative quality information about plans and physician networks in place. I think that we've done some remarkable work in the last few years in trying to develop the technology of quality comparisons. We've done a poor job in disseminating that and making it understandable for the American public. We have got to do that. And I hope that is common ground for consumers and the health plans alike.
Thanks, Ron. Okay, well, our speakers have done a great job of sort of giving you a feel for where they stand in these issues, and we're going to try to dig a little bit deeper on some of these topics. There are so many of them that we're obviously not going to get to them all. But we have some terrific questions here that you've sent up, and I had prepared some questions of my own. I think I'm going to disregard them because these are a lot better. I want to pick up on the patient's bill of rights because Ron was arguing, Karen, that and his, you know, when you listen to what he is saying in terms of authorization for emergency room care, drugs off the formulary mm-hmm. when people need them, being able to go outside of the network when you need to see a specialist for a chronic condition or something, and the right to sue a health plan if you feel that you've been wronged. These are all issues that to some people might sound like they make some sense. However, the industry lobbied fairly hard against the patient's bill of rights, and I don't know whether that was opposition to all of these issues, but perhaps you could tell us where you stand on the ones that Ron mentioned.
I'd be delighted to. First of all, I didn't dodge the issue of the Bill of Rights. I tried to stick to the topic, which was more about quality, but I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk about it. What Ron has laid out doesn't resemble any of the pieces of legislation that have been talked about on Capitol Hill. In fact, his prescription is a very rational, reasonable, and balanced prescription, with the exception of the additional liability, which I suspect if we had more time to talk about, there may be more consensus there than is apparent on the surface. But we are very worried. People now have the ability to sue health plans when things go wrong, when there are quality problems. The issue on Capitol Hill is about suing over coverage questions so that no employer, no union, no state government could ever again buy a package of benefits and be confident that it wouldn't be second-guessed in the courts. That is the quickest way to disassemble the health care system we have today. That may be the right thing from some people's perspective, but it has grave consequences. And I don't think that we've had a proper dialogue about the costs versus the benefits with respect to trial lawyers. You can only look at the suits that have already been undertaken to look at the aggressive tactics and look at who in the end is going to bear the cost of this aggressiveness of trial lawyers. It's not the trial lawyers. It's physicians. It's consumers. It's working families.
Ron. Yeah, I guess I want to correct a misunderstanding about this issue about the right to sue. There is a right to sue under current law, but it's very much misunderstood, and it comes under the so-called ERISA statute enacted in 1974. The ERISA statute does two things. One, it regulates what the states can do, and secondly, it tells you what the federal government can do. The biggest issue so far is what the ERISA statute does with respect to state laws that authorize the right to sue. There are seven states to date that have enacted legislation, including California, that gives you the right to sue an HMO. Now, there's a question as to whether those statutes are going to be found to be preempted by the ERISA statute. There is a recent case law that came out in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans 3 weeks ago, which in effect might tell you what's going to happen in California. This actually focused on the Texas statute. And what the court there said was that they construed the Texas statute as allowing you to sue if an HMO provides services but provides them poorly. So it's in the nature of malpractice. But the court went on to say, if we construed the statute to allow you to sue when an HMO provides no service at all because it says that that service is not medically necessary, the court said if we had construed the statute to go that far, we would have preempted it under the ERISA statute. So the states, on the most important issue about the right to sue, when an HMO denies or delays care, it appears that the states are severely limited. On the federal side, however, there is a right to sue. It's uncontested. The issue is, what is the remedy? Not whether you can get into court. It's uncontested that you can get into court. And under the ERISA statute, what you're allowed to do is, if you sue and you prevail after your 2 or 3 years of litigation, the only remedy that can be prescribed by the federal court is that you can get the service that was originally denied to you or its monetary equivalent. Now think about that for a moment. That is too little and too late. The reason I want a right to sue is not because I like trial lawyers. As a dean of a law school, I know some of the problems with our court system, and they are profound, and they're not trivial. But the reason I would like a right to sue is I would like to make sure there's a deterrence. I want an HMO, when it's thinking about making a life or death decision, to know that there is potentially something more at stake than ultimately being told 3 years later that they had to provide the service, now provided at a point when it's too late. So I think deterrence is what's important here. But I think where we would not contest one another is, I think all of us understand that once you're in litigation, the system has failed. Because at that point, the patient has been harmed. That patient hasn't gotten the care they needed. And no matter what the money judgment is, it really doesn't make that person truly whole. And so we've got to establish systems that are going to make sure that litigation is minimized.
Okay. Let's move on. It's sort of a related question here. Ron mentioned a Supreme Court decision recently that involved whether or not a patient could sue in federal court. And in that court, in that Supreme Court decision, the court brought up a word that for most of us is kind of a bad word, the R word, known as rationing, which to most people seems to imply that you're doing something to deny care that somebody really ought to be receiving. But there's a lot of interpretations of that word. But I think that it brings to mind one of the questions that continue to plague people or bother people about the managed care system, which is this issue of physicians that are given bonuses or financial incentives when they're able to hold down costs. And the Supreme Court in that decision said that the HMO system, the managed care system, was a cost containment system and that this was a reasonable thing for managed care to do, and they didn't really want to get involved in making decisions about that. But for many people, that is a troubling idea, that a doctor would not be thinking necessarily just about what's best medically, but whether or not they're going to reduce the bonus that they might receive at the end of the year. And even though a particular decision that the doctor may make wouldn't necessarily result in a bonus, their group as a whole may be able to hold down costs and therefore make a little bit more money at the end of the year. I think, Karen, that this is an issue that still troubles a lot of people. I wonder if you could address that. Does the HMO system involve rationing, and is that necessarily a bad thing?
In the health plan community, there is every incentive to do as much as possible as early as possible. And let's make this real. If you're a woman in a certain part of a country, you are at higher risk, if you have breast cancer, of having a radical mastectomy than having a lumpectomy. You want an entity, a group of physicians, that are evaluating whether or not the recommendations that have been made are in sync with the science and the latest research. We, unfortunately, in the health plan community, when we talk about the track record, the research now indicates that we are doing a better job on cancer, on cardiac care, on diabetes, and the whole range of chronic illnesses that each and every one of us in our families will experience or have experienced. That is undeniable. That's the legacy. Do we have procedural challenges? Are we making recommendations with respect to physicians that have always practiced in a particular way to suggest they should practice to research, they should practice to the best practice? Yes, we are. And what we haven't done enough of in the health plan community is to take the cover off the black box, stand up and talk about exactly what we do, how we do it, how health plans' decision-making different from physicians, how they both go together, and how together they can improve care. And we haven't had a debate in Washington that hasn't actually looked at the track record, that seems to be prepared to willy-nilly throw it out and then start again or go back to the old system. That's what's at stake. So do we make recommendations? Do we look at how procedures are appropriated, allocated, what have you? Yes. The gold standard is the right care at the right time in the right setting. That is something that is in the patient's interest. It's for the patient. Having an external review system on top of that certainly provides an opportunity for evaluation, for critique, and for procedural justice. And I think that's an opportunity for us to think about a platform that's far more productive than suing our way to better health care.
Ron, do you want to take that question? I mean, do we want HMOs, managed care companies, deciding what is an appropriate level of care?
Well, the question that you raised in the beginning about incentives, the bonuses, the court has now settled that issue, and they settled it on a 9-0 vote. I'm more concerned about the setting in which these bonuses may be provided and this compensation is provided. If you have a large risk pool, if the group that is getting higher bonuses is serving a very large pool of people, I'm not as troubled about that as I am when you get with smaller groups. Because in smaller groups, if you have one person who's got a significant health problem, that can throw the entire cost of that particular practice out of line, and that creates a very, very strong disincentive not to provide the care that's necessary. If you can spread that risk more broadly, I am not quite as troubled as I am when you don't have that capacity to spread the risk broadly. Obviously, it is very disquieting for consumers to feel that decisions are being made based on financial considerations rather than good health considerations. And unfortunately, that is the legacy of that system. It may result in better productivity. It may result in cost containment, and I think it probably does. But in terms of the other legacy that it creates in terms of questioning for patients whether a physician is making a decision based on financial or good health considerations, that is mighty troublesome, because I think the strength of our healthcare system is in the patient, physician, and other provider relationship. And once that gets undermined, I think it does a great deal of damage to our healthcare system.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Now, I know that both Karen and Ron are very interested in the issue of the uninsured. And while this is not strictly a managed care issue, it's really a broader issue, I think, for our society in general. Certainly, managed care plays a role in this because of their dominance and presence in the healthcare industry. So this is a question from one of our audience. How is the healthcare industry addressing the disparities in healthcare, the unique health problems of the poor and special ethnic groups who are frequently uninsured, such issues as infant mortality, HIV, iron deficiency, and lead poisoning? Karen, do you want to start with that in terms of how you see the role of your industry in addressing this problem? And I should just add that while the managed care enrollment has been going up and up over the past 10 years, the number of uninsured is also going up, which raises a question as to if managed care was going to improve access by lowering the cost of care, why is that happening?
Well, there are several reasons for that. The reason it's happening, because the nature of our employment has changed quite substantially. We've moved out of a system where many people are working for large employers, where more the growth has been in the small sector, the independent sector. Many people are moving into self-employment, consulting, et cetera, and so that has fueled the numbers moving in the way they are. I think that one of the most challenging issues for us as a society is to confront this head on. And I think both political candidates are right. It's not an either-or proposition. It is a combination of public sector strategies and private sector strategies. But the disappointing thing from my perspective as a citizen watching this debate and been involved in it for a number of years is that when after the campaigns finish, you see very few politicians willing to enter the political sphere and actually commit the resources necessary to do this job. It's a question of opportunity costs. And what we as a society need to do is to stand up and say, yes, this will be a priority. Yes, we're going to commit the resources because the entire productivity of our nation depends on it. To have the best healthcare system in the world with so many finding that they have this, the system is out of reach, it's not only inexplicable, but it's unfair, it's unwarranted, and it's time to do something about it. So there's no shortage of policy solutions. That's not the problem. It's the political will to commit the resources. And that's where, after the campaigns finish, rhetoric ends, that's where, unfortunately, the action has slowed down.
I have two pessimistic fragments to the response and one optimistic response. The two pessimistic responses, one of the things that we've learned through some studies that were done just in the last year is not only are we seeing an increase in the number of people who are uninsured, but there is a significant correlation in terms of uncompensated care provided to uninsured people depending on the managed care penetration in an area. And the deeper the penetration of managed care in communities, the less uncompensated care is being provided. So not only do we have more people are uninsured, but the inexplicit safety net by which they can get care is being reduced. That's number one. Number two, I've been very disappointed that the industry has raised the issue of the uninsured in a very defensive manner. When we've had this debate about the Patient's Bill of Rights, the most common argument that has been made by the industry has been, this is going to add costs, and those costs are going to bring X number of people to the ranks of the uninsured, and isn't that horrible? And yet, every time we've had an opportunity to do something about the uninsured, the industry has not been there as part of that debate. So I've been very disappointed about that. Now, my hope, however, and my optimism is that, and I can't go into it in great detail because it's a subject for another discussion, but we have conducted a series of meetings with the health insurance industry recently, and I'm very hopeful that we are going to come up with a joint plan that consumers and the insurance industry can get behind Foursquare that is going to make significant inroads in the number of people who are uninsured. And I hope that the industry will feel adequately challenged, not just to say, yes, we're in favor of doing something about the uninsured, but really rolling up their sleeves and using their lobbying clout and the resources that they have, that they've brought to bear on a variety of issues, and bring it to bear on this issue as well. It's the number one moral issue in the healthcare system in America, and the industry cannot stand on the sidelines about it. They can't just say we've got a plan and then do nothing about it. They've really got to work it.
Karen, do you want to comment briefly on Ron's contention that you haven't?
I sure do. Ron is a longstanding friend of mine, so I'm not sure what industry he's referring to, but for the American Association of Health Plans, our members have actually been the leaders in providing children's health, been the way we've actually shown the light and developed systems that have helped states actually expand coverage in that area and done a whole range of things in various communities that add to the fabric of those communities in long-standing and sustainable ways. So we are delighted to participate in discussion and have long participated in discussions about the uninsured. Perhaps there are other aspects of the industry to which Ron is referring, but our members stand ready, willing, and able, but we need to be very specifically focused on what the barriers to moving this discussion forth are. And it's a little too easy for politicians to be let off the hook. And I think it's time for the citizens of this country to demand action. And we will be there, and we want to play a leading role in that.
Okay, I think this will have to be the last question. I'm sorry about that. And the quick responses on this. This deals with the issue of mental health coverage. And this is a question from the audience that says, and I'm going to let Ron go first on this one because I think Karen's gone first on a couple of the others. When is the managed care industry going to accept that mental illness is no different from other chronic illnesses such as diabetes, cholesterol problems, and asthma, and that we need to provide a high level of benefits for mental health needs? Ron, what do you think of that question?
I think when the payers of care accept that as well, whether that employers and government accepts it as well, I'm pleased to see that we're beginning to develop a movement towards parity between mental health care and physical health care. It's a slow-moving process, but it really is picking up steam, and it's picking up bipartisan steam. And I believe that we're going to move significantly in the direction of parity. Certainly the Vice President and his wife have made this a very top issue throughout the last few years, and many other politicians who are not normally in the fray on health care have joined that effort. So I'm hopeful that we will see that change in the not-too-distant future.
I agree with that completely. I think that we've made some great strides in developing this concept of parity and beginning to get our hands around precisely what that means and how to execute to that standard. So I think that we have similar challenges in other areas, but there has been a lot of progress made. There's more that needs to be made, but I think that the purchasers are becoming far more committed to that goal, and they are the payers, and they are the decision makers with respect to the benefit package. And we have an important role to play in the managed care community in making it possible for them to be comfortable with that principle.
So there are some areas where you and Ron do agree.
Oh, absolutely.
Any others that either of you would want to mention just so we end on a...
I very much like her son.
Well, and we agree on external review, but Ron wants to emphasize liability for purposes of tonight's discussion.
Okay. Well, that's all for the questions. So on behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California and the California Healthcare Foundation, I want to thank Karen Ignani, President and CEO of the American Society of Health Plans, and Ron Pollack, Executive Director of Families USA, for joining us this evening. And also to thank all of our listeners, both here and those listening on the radio. I'm David Almos, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned. Thank you.